What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Cheeky Midweekie, where we are making strength and conditioning not boring anymore. And we do that by highlighting the practitioners that make this the best field in athletics. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Lance Brooks, who is currently a postdoctoral researcher at UMass Lowell. Prior to this, he was working down at the SMU Locomotion Lab, where he was a doctoral student. During this conversation, we talk about the force velocity profiling. We talk about how people misunderstand it and how it should actually be utilized. We also talk about all sorts of different research when it comes to sprinting. You're going to love this episode. It was a pleasure talking to him. Enjoy it. Dr. Lance Brooks, thank you for coming on the show. There's a bunch of other things you could be doing right now. I greatly appreciate you allowing me and our listeners to learn from you. My first question for you is, from my perspective, the SMU Performance Lab is famous. Like, what makes it so special there? Because you got to see it firsthand for 4 years.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be able to come on these sorts of platforms and share some of the stuff that I've been working on and hopefully bring some value to the field in my own special way. But the Locomotive Performance Lab at SMU, which is actually now at TCU. My advisor, mentor, has moved on. He took a chair position at the kinesiology department at TCU. So picked up and moved the lab. So it was, you know, just in time for my exodus from Texas. So yeah, he's actually at TCU now. Still the same name, the Locomotive Performance Lab. But SMU, what makes that lab special, really is just the sheer perspective on performance issues that comes from the legacy of scientists and that lineage, and just also the technical capabilities of the lab. I mean, the fastest treadmill in the world, able to measure force in three dimensions at 1,000 frames per second. The acceleration stuff that I was capable of measuring and the questions that we're able to answer. But then again, probably the most special thing is just the lineage of intellectuals that have come through, you know, that lab in particular, but then also the people who inspired the lab to even know what questions to ask and where to look. And I think some of those things are lost on a lot of individuals in the field, is asking the right questions and sort of knowing first principles and really getting intimately involved with where the ideas come from and function at the most basic level. Because something that I always think about is how people can overcomplicate things because things sound fancy, things sound sciencey. And that's just not the school that I come from. That's not the school of thought and the lineage that I come from. We come from, if you really know the basics, if you really know things through and through, it actually sheds a lot of light on how simple things really can be. You can't think outside the box until you know to an expert level what's in the box. And that's just something that is ingrained in me as a scientist, and that comes from the people that came before me. So those that came before me walk so I can run, so to speak, no pun intended. But
that's a good pun, though. I appreciate a good dad joke right there. Hearing you talk about the scientific method, it made me think about the fact that a lot of times I feel like strength and conditioning coaches maybe get the scientific method wrong, where instead of thinking like, hey, what's the problem we're trying to solve and how can we use this piece of technology and this research to fix it? They're like, oh, we got to get this. Hey, how can we use it? That's not the scientific method and the scientific process at all. No. Could you talk it through so that way our listeners can be like, okay, they can do better practice as strength coaches?
Yeah, absolutely. My philosophy on scientific method is, I guess when you think about scientific method and you think about how it's taught, if it's taught in grade school these days, I don't even know what they're teaching kids these days, but whenever the scientific method is taught to you, like in the fourth grade, they always establish it. Like, they give you a project to work on and you have to establish your problem, come up with a question. Then you have your hypothesis. Then you have to come up with some way to test your hypothesis, and then interpretations, and then your conclusions. that's not my view of the scientific method. That's sort of a linearized way of approaching the scientific method, whereas I see it much more as a circle, and you can jump in that loop at any time in the process. So you could be observing something and then come up with a question, and then through that process of forming a hypothesis and coming up with an experiment, other questions are going to pop up along the way. And sometimes you can be doing your literature assessment. You could be going in and just kind of catching up with what's going on in the literature, and you might have an epiphany moment. You can be trying to ask one question, and another question will arise from it somewhere in your, and maybe your hypothesis was incorrect in your interpretations, or your data interpretations show that, oh, we were thinking about this wrong the whole time, and so you have to kind of go back to tweak things. So it's never going to be a linear process entirely. It's much more of a circle. And I think there's a draw to some of these fancy gadgets that come with price tags. They come with significant price tags. There's a draw because everybody, rightfully so, and I don't blame anybody for this, that everybody wants that wow factor. They want to bring something that hardly anyone else is. And I think that you can't see the forest from the trees if you're just focusing on the technology and the equipment that you're investing in when you've not invested in the time and in your own intellectual journey to know how to think through certain things. So it's really about an opportunity cost and where you're allocating your resources, and time is a resource. And of course it takes time to sit down and really get intimate knowledge and familiarity with first principles, just even really knowing Newton's laws and how they relate to each other and how those things affect motion. So the majority of my research is focused on force, motion, and energy systems at the whole body level. And more recently, I'm getting into muscle mechanics and muscle models. And when you know the basic, when you really know through and through how things function, then some of the things that are marketed as $20,000 price tag items, you really start to realize that you don't necessarily need these things in order to provide more value.
Get CEUs faster, cheaper, and more convenient than ever before with Strength Coach Network. Hey, it's Justin, here to tell you about how Strength Coach Network can now help you out with our premium membership and CEUs to the NSCA and CSCCA. Upon signing up for our premium membership, you will get 2.0 or 10 CEUs immediately. That is an entire year's worth of CEUs that you are able to access from the convenience of your office. No traveling for conferences, no waiting on flights, no eating out, no expensive hotels. Just the good stuff from great coaches. Now, if you need extra CEUs for past years during the reporting period, we can bundle Fundamentals 1 or 2, which also come with 2.0 or 10 CEUs, to your purchase. That way, you're able to take care of your CEUs for the best price, most convenient, and learn from some of the best coaches. If you want more help with this, email us at service@strengthcoachnetwork.com or visit us at strengthcoachnetwork.com, and I would be delighted to help you out.
No, not at all. And like, that's, to me, I've dialed it down personally to like the most important thing, like, you know, having a force plate. If you don't always have your force plate, that have a jump measurement device, having your velocity based training, having some integration of, you know, being able to distribute your training. Like I said, off air, I work in the private sector. So some of the athletes, they're with us in person, some of them are at home. Being able to use Team Builder, or at the high school I'm at, we've got 80 something athletes. Like, if we're printing lift cards, like, that's too much of a work. But, you know, outside of some of those main basic things, you know, hearing you say about the TCU thing, what I wrote there is like, man, Cause and RJ being able to send athletes and utilize that relationship. And just, so any of our strength coaches listening there, like, what I'm saying is, get your first principles, the most important ones, and then look for relationships where you can work with kinesiology departments or a performance lab, and you can really almost expand your staff because of utilizing people that want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I need to be better about as a scientist when I put my, because I mean, I have experience in on, you know, on both sides of the spectrum in terms of, you know, performance. I have quite a bit of applied performance experience, a couple of NCAA internships. I was a graduate assistant strength coach during my master's. And then I sort of got away from coaching during my PhD journey. But now we've started a new company where I'm now engaging with athletes on in a more applied way again. But sort of having the experience on both sides, I really try to leverage that to connect with coaches. And sometimes the work that I do can, you know, the terminology, the jargon, it can be esoteric, and it's going to go over people's heads because they just don't necessarily have the same training. And so I try to formulate things to connect with coaches so they can understand that's something that that's an ever evolving process. That's something that I'm always having to get better at. And sometimes I can see the results of when it's effective and then when I've not been a very effective communicator. Because I have relationships with certain practitioners, clinicians and coaches, and I'll find myself, you know, year after year kind of coming in and having the same conversations with them when they have the same questions. I'm like, I've not done my job then as a scientist, as a science communicator, because clearly some of the messages that I've tried to get across have not gotten through entirely. So that's from my end of things, is I have to do my job in communicating to, you know, the people who don't have the same expertise that I have.
What's up, everybody? Taking a quick break from the show to talk about one of our sponsors, TeamBuilder. I've been using TeamBuilder since 2019 when I was at Towson. I still use it with my remote athletes. I also use it at Goldfinch, which is the private sector gym I train at, and we use it at Centennial, which is the high school that I'm working at. Now, if you're printing on lift cards because you say, oh, I can't afford TeamBuilder, guess what? TeamBuilder has a pre-written grant that you can locate on their website. You simply change the name of you, your organization, and the areas that they highlighted, and they can help you get TeamBuilder at your facility, your university, whatever it is, so that way you can optimize how you train your athletes with this software. Now, TeamBuilder is also a part owner in the PlyoMat. The PlyoMat is something that I utilize at Goldfinch, and it helps you be able to see how high somebody jumped, the ground contact time, and RSI. You can get all that conveniently right there. You can reach out to your rep from TeamBuilder to be able to get more information on the PlyoMat. It's fast, it's reliable, it's convenient, and it's trusted by coaches worldwide. Check them out, as well as TeamBuilder, in the link down below.
Within that, one of the things you and I were talking off air about is, you know, you're studying on rats and not only just on, you know, humans. How does that implication work? Because I know sometimes strength coaches will read research and it's on an animal, and 9 times out of 10, strength coaches throw it away. Why should they not do that?
Because some of the things, in fact, most of the things that we know about muscle function in humans and how things move, and depending on the task, you know, running uphill or running on flat ground, jumps, almost everything we know about how muscle behaves, what the contractile dynamics are during in vivo motion. In vivo is basically just running around like within the organism, just like, so that's in vivo function. Everything we know comes from animal models and comparative experiments. And we're all made from the same stuff. So we know these things, and we use complex tools to measure these things. We use sonomicrometry crystals. We're using servo motors with levers. So basically force dynamometers on motion. So like we basically detach the origin or the insertion of the muscle with the origin still intact and on an anesthetized animal, and we're able to measure force, velocity, contractile dynamics. And so we know these things about how force relates to motion at the muscle level and up from comparative experiments. And so this is sort of what I mean about really knowing first principles. You don't need necessarily to read every animal study that's out there, because, you know, there's not always going to be carryover to what we want to know as applied performance practitioners. But there are reviews there's reviews circling out there that have a message that's more applied. So you can really wrap your head around just how muscle works. But some of the work out there is really like, you know, the sort of like service papers for those who are doing, you know, animal comparative experiments so that they can improve their experiments. Coaches don't need to be reading those things, but knowing, for example, force velocity relationship, we know it's a characteristic of muscle. So people misunderstand it and misinterpret it, and they think that it applies to whole body motion. And so they'll put assignments of certain exercises along the force velocity curve, but that's a misinterpretation of the force velocity relationship. And if you know what the actual force velocity relationship says and where it comes from, it'll either increase or decrease your confidence in how well we know it. But then you'll also understand it more. You'll understand what it actually means.
Will you unpack that more about the force velocity relationship? That I just wrote that down. Double click on that thought.
Yeah. So force velocity relationship is basically an inherent trade-off between muscle tension and shortening velocity during isolated muscles and isolated muscle fibers. And these come from single fiber experiments like in frog muscles. Those are like the early experiments. A.V. Hill did those. And, you know, more recently, we've done them on larger animals and whole muscles and sort of seen that that force-velocity relationship is an emergent property of the sarcomeres, which is like that's the functional unit of the cell. It's the actual, where the myosin and the actin overlap, right? So myosin pulls on actin. So that force, that tension-velocity trade-off exists at the sarcomere level, and then it goes upward. That's an emergent property. And so we see that it's basically a relationship between the maximum tension that a muscle can produce at a given shortening velocity. And we can say that there's a load velocity trade-off at the whole body. So if you're doing a barbell squat, the heavier you load up on the bar, the slower the maximal movement's gonna be, right? That's slow. And of course, those come from the force velocity. The reason why that happens is because of the force velocity relationship at the muscle level, but it's really a tension thing, right? It's not, hey, this exercise is going to work this part of the curve, whereas this exercise is going to work this part of the curve. So it's really a misnomer when people do that. And oftentimes when you see those graphics where they show the exercises along the curve, they put sprinting as the fastest one with the lowest muscle tension, which is actually completely false.
Right?
Yeah, the highest when it comes to sprinting, it's either high force, high velocity, or low force, low velocity. Because what's happening during level sprinting, max effort, is the muscles are acting quasi-isometric. So yep. There's going to be some lengthening, a little bit of lengthening and a little bit of shortening when the foot hits the ground and when it comes off. So you're kind of hovering around this isometric point where the tendon is taking up most of the length change. And so the isometric is the maximum tension of the muscle where there's no muscle shortening happening. So you're operating on one part of the curve, whereas the people who don't quite understand the force velocity relationship will say, oh, since you're moving really fast, you're operating on this side of the curve, which is a complete misunderstanding.
What's up, everybody? Taking a quick break from the show to talk about one of our sponsors, Hawken Dynamic. I've been using Hawken Dynamics ever since I was at Towson. Still utilize it today when I'm at the private sector at Goldfinch. Even brought the plates from Goldfinch over to Centennial to do some force plate testing with the football team there. We've done force plate testing with other high school athletes. It is something that you need to get. If you want more help with it about how to practically use it and you want to reach out to us, feel free to reach out to us at service@strengthcoachnetwork.com. Not only do I utilize it with lower body assessments, I use it with upper body assessments, plyo pushups, prone Y assessments. You can also utilize it for what I call an upper body isometric mid thigh pull, where essentially you're doing a push-up at the strongest range and you're pushing into an immovable force, so a barbell, same way you do an isometric mid thigh pull. Like I said, been using them for years, valid, reliable. The customer service is fantastic. Go check out Hawken Dynamic in the link down below and you will not be disappointed.
Yeah, and like especially with the research that had been coming out of there, and you were with Dr. Ken Clark as well, and like just the research that comes out from anybody talking about sprinting, ground contact time is like five times your body weight. That's right. Not low force, but it is at fast speed. So it's like, it doesn't just fit nicely where it's like, oh, heavy back squats, Olympic lifts, med ball throws, sprinting.
Exactly. Yeah. There is it's a misunderstanding, and it's just one of those things among many where I feel strongly that if practitioners would really take the time to sit down and understand these first principles, what the implications that these relationships have on whole body performance and the things that they have their athletes doing and how they interpret improvements or non-improvements, I think it would go a long way to helping inform practice.
One of the things that I wrote down here was, did you guys ever do any like muscle dyes? Is there a way that like somebody could drink something and like, oh, or how could you do a dye on a muscle to see when they're running, you know, activation? Was EMG, were you doing biopsies? What were some of the things that you were doing down there or methodologies that you kind of want to speak to let coaches understand more when they're reading journals and different research?
So in the SMU lab, we weren't doing any actual muscle experiments in that sense. Okay. Where it's the focus of the lab is the mechanical, the relationship between mechanics and energy level at the whole body level. And so I had colleagues doing jumping studies, had colleague doing different shoes, and you know, how the foot interacts with the ground and how things are affected from the ground up. My focus, again, whole body level stuff, is the kinematics of limbs and kinematics of the whole body and the interaction between the foot and the ground, so ground reaction forces. Got it. And the key things that you need to know when you're doing those kinds of experiments is you have to have a really strong grip on Newtonian mechanics and Newton's three laws, impulse momentum, some sort of basic level calculus. And then of course, just being able to just interpreting the performance in linking it to the biology. So we're a physics lab and a biology lab. So really it's the classical mechanics that you need to have a strong grip on, but then you have to be able to link it to what's happening physiologically. And so that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of doing good science in that setting and doing impactful work. And so if I were to say, if anyone wants to interpret my research or the research of my colleagues from the SMU lab, if they have a strong basis in just classical mechanics, they don't have to be experts, but if they truly fully understand classical mechanics and then sort of just more, just north of the basics on physiology, because there's, you know, from an undergrad exercise physiology course, there's going to be some things that are presented in a certain way that are actually a little bit misleading, and you have to dig deeper. You have to go beyond what you learned sitting in the classroom. I'm not saying go to gurus and learn what they have to say because they have the next best thing and they have these ideas that nobody else has thought of. I'm saying just dig deeper into the principles that you were presented so that you know that you have a deeper understanding about it.
What's up, y'all? Taking a quick break from the show to talk to you about another one of our sponsors, Vitruv. I've been utilizing Vitruv for a while now, and I absolutely love the convenience of this app. The encoder is at a price that you cannot beat compared to the competitors. Also, I don't personally like the camera apps. I've known that they continue to break down, and I really enjoy having this encoder attached directly to the bar. Vitruv does that. Not only does it do that, but it'll show me velocity loss during the set, shows me average velocity, all of it right within the app. Not only that, for the app on the individual athlete, there's a Vitruv Teams app where now as the coach, I can see all the results from my athletes. I can API that into my team builder. And now everything that I'm trying to do, get better competition, better intent in the weight room, I am able to do with Vitruv. If you want more information about them, click the link down below, or you can ask us questions directly at service@strengthcoachnetwork.com. And we would love to answer those questions for you.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And having a deeper understanding, I guess the question that I kept asking myself there was, were you seeing any, like, was there a big takeaway about like, okay, specialized exercises that can help with sprint mechanics or, you know, team sport versus track and field athlete? What were some of the big, like, okay, put the coach hat on, take the practitioner or take the researcher hat off? What were some of the big takeaways that you had from that?
So, yeah, we talk about this often in our research group. When we talk about training for sprinting, a lot of people, again, misinterpreting the forces that we're talking about. We're talking about you have to be very forceful as a sprinter, and they think, okay, I got to be stronger. My athletes need to be stronger, so I need to load them up on barbells. I need to have them do these hex bar deadlifts or what have you, because it's the strength of the leg that's going to make me more forceful to run faster. Not the case, because again, during those tasks versus the sprinting task, the muscle's behaving differently. So in order to improve at a task, you need to do the task or things need to be similar. So when we always talk about Carl Lewis famously or infamously bragged that he never touched a weight. He was a notorious non-lifter. We also talk about that Allison Felix's coach is on record saying that when she was a junior or senior in high school, she couldn't even deadlift her own body weight. So these are two examples of the elite of the elite not expressing a whole lot of weight room strength, and in some cases not doing it at all, not even lifting. So if we're talking about top speed sprinting, the things that determine optimal performance or maximizing performance are those short contact times, hitting the ground as hard as you can, hitting the ground very stiffly, because those high forces are ground reaction forces. They're not muscle forces, although the muscle forces are high. They're ground reaction forces, and they're set by the motion. They're set by a stiff ankle striking the ground and getting up in a very short amount of time. And then the physics dictate that based on your body weight and the short amount of time that you're spending on the ground actually supporting yourself, those peak forces are going to be massive. But it's set by the motion, and it's set just by the physics in that sense. But it's not set by weight room strength. And then flipping that on its head a little bit, people think, okay, top speed sprinting, that's not necessarily going to be determined by your weight room strength. But acceleration, since you're actually pushing more, and it's more aligned with a squat pattern, or those, you know, the way the excursion that the hip and knees go through is definitely more similar to weight room strength, right? To which I say, and based on my research, which is still to be published, we're working on this, so keep an eye out for the next year or so, is early acceleration, even during a block start, where the acceleration is the highest that it is at any point in the sprint, where you look at a block start and you see somebody exploding like a Justin Gatlin, you think, okay, there's no way that he's not using all the strength that he has in his legs. But really, there's other things at play in terms of limitations. The limitations are going to be much more external. And so the need to support your body against gravity never goes away. So you still have to do that even during a block start. So there's three things you need to do during acceleration. You need to push down to support your body weight. You need to push back so that the ground can push you back, as ground reaction force can push you up and forward into the direction you want. So you need to push down, you need to push back, and you need to push through your center of mass to avoid any unsavory rotations, either forward or backwards, like a wheelie. So for a balanced push, you need to direct through the center of mass, pushing down and back. So they need to be roughly equal. So that's going to limit you to somewhere around 45 degrees. If you go any lower than 45 degrees thinking, oh, I'm going to push just lower, lower, lower so I can accelerate more horizontally faster, faster, you're not going to be able to push downward with the requisite forces to support your body weight. So you're going to fall forward. So there's going to be a minimum angle that you're just not going to be able to get past. But then you also don't want to push too far down, because the angle of your push is going to be this way and you're going to soar through the air with longer aerial times. And when you're in the air, you're not pushing on the ground. And when you're not pushing on the ground, you're not accelerating. So there's sort of a sweet spot that we're finding. It's a sweet spot between the vertical and the horizontal, where they're not going to be able to push very much past 45 degrees.
And that's all based on from everything that I've read and what other strength coaches, if they heard that, they'd be like, and that's all based upon the relative strength of the athlete, correct?
They would think so, right? But they would think during a block start, you're using all the strength that you have. But if the idea is that there's going to be a limit to how far you can push or how hard you can push in the two important directions, vertical and horizontal, then there's going to be sort of a natural tapering back on the forces that you can apply because of balance reasons.
How would you answer the question, is somebody fast because they're strong or strong because they're fast?
I've seen a lot of strong folks who are not very fast and a lot of fast folks who are not very strong. So you want my opinion? I say no relationship.
Ooh.
Or very, very weak one.
Yeah, and it's because really
It's not about strength in the traditional sense that way. It's about being forceful. But again, the forces are determined by motion. But then it's also force with respect to your body weight. So it has to be, it's a mass specific force, because Newton's second law is that is F equal MA. So you can rearrange that. It's A equal F over M. So force divided by body mass. So you have an incentive to not be carrying around a whole lot of body mass, even if it's contractile tissue, even if it's muscle, because muscle's heavy. So even if you have strength and you have muscle, you still have to carry it around. It's going to weigh you down, and it's going to harm that ratio of force over mass. So that's why you see the best sprinters in the world, they walk around very lean. They don't want any extra fat, certainly, but they also don't want too much muscle, because they have to carry it around. You don't see that same thing, like, for example, with sprint cyclists, because the mechanical requirements in sprint cycling are different. So you see them walking around with these big, massive defensive lineman thighs, because they're just pushing on the pedal and they're constantly pushing. They don't have to get themselves up in the air at any point during their cycling. So the mechanical requirements are different. So you actually see it in how their anthropometry is expressed.
Taking a quick break from the show to talk to you about one of our sponsors, Powerlift. I used Powerlift when I was at Harvard, Maryland, and the University of Iowa. I was also part of the staff that had the new weight room at the University of Iowa, the 32-rack beautiful facility. I was a part of that. I also have Powerlift's equipment nowadays. Powerlift Strong, made here in the great state of Iowa, in the great country of the United States. They're able to work with you on any customizations that you need, logos, height, whatever it is, the limitations that you have. Their equipment is strong. The people there, they're very good people. Check them out in the link down below. And if you have any questions on how to work with them, reach out to us at service@strengthcoachnetwork.com, and we would be delighted to help.
Yeah, and I wrote it down here. I made the it's you're right, it's a matrix. You're strong in the weight room and fast. You're strong in the weight room, you could be slow, weak in the weight room and slow, weak in the weight room and fast.
Like exactly.
It is a matrix. I think Dr. Ken Clark talked about that before with, like, because DK Metcalf was big and strong and he was fast. So everybody wanted to make, but it's like, okay, well, Devontae Smith, sure, he's strong, but he's not as big. So don't make Devontae Smith look like DK Metcalf. Let Devontae Smith be Devontae Smith.
Right, right. Yeah, I will say, though, DK Metcalf's performance was rather impressive for a man of his size.
Correct. I'm not trying to take anything away from him. Not even a little bit.
I remember watching him just being like, wow, that guy can move.
What is something that still is misinterpreted about ground contact time? Because fly 10s, I think, have done real good to make strength coaches aware, like, all right, get our athletes fast, do fast things. What is still misunderstood that I think more strength coaches, or that you think more strength coaches need to understand?
I think, and there's a couple of things, but the question brings up one thing that jumps out at me immediately. And it's that it's not so much that they misinterpret the contact time issue. Some do, but it's really what the leg is doing during that contact time. And the thing that I often see is usually as it relates to braking forces. And there's a belief that is still prevalent that you want to minimize braking force. You want to minimize braking force, so you want to strike directly beneath the center of mass, or maybe even just slightly out in front of the center of mass. But you want to strike beneath the center of mass, and that's going to reduce your contact time, and it's going to reduce your braking forces. The problem with that is that absolutely nobody on planet Earth does that. Not a single person strikes the ground directly beneath their center of mass during top speed sprinting. It's just not possible. Because, like I was saying with the block start and the early acceleration, the three things you need to do is push down, back, and through your center of mass. That applies at top speed sprinting too. In order to avoid those rotations that we're talking about, the push has to go through center of mass all the time. And so it's the braking forces are required during extremely fast sprinting. So you'll see you have to strike the ground in front of you so that you're going to get a ground reaction force through your center of mass so that your leg can then pass over your foot and then the vector goes the other way. So it's sort of like it's parabolic. So you strike the ground and your center mass is going to slow down just for a little bit during the first part of the stride, but then it picks back up. So if you look at the velocity curves during sprinting, they do this. They oscillate. It's sinusoidal. It's a lowering of velocity and raising, lowering and raising, lowering and raising. And that's what's happening when the foot hits the ground when it comes back up. So it's never a perfectly smooth, steady state of velocity. There's things that we don't see with the naked eye, but the braking forces are certainly a physical, mechanical requirement for fast sprinting.
Speaking of the naked eye, with you being and seeing so many things, you said 1,000 frames per second, like how are you able to see things in real time without like, not how are you, how did you train your coaching eye and your real time eye from seeing so many different frames to be like, yep, I can see that. And then when you slow it down and show it to somebody, like, son of a gun, he's right. How was that process?
Well, it starts out, and again, I'm not going to claim that I have the perfect coach's eye, because as a scientist, I learn that more often than not, intuition fails you. So even today, when I'm looking at an athlete, not necessarily for research, because for research, I film everything. You have to, because for research to do good science, you need very strong signals. So you need to be able to capture everything. So I don't even leave it up to my coach's eye. But when I am working with an athlete in an applied setting, I never fully take my scientist cap off. So I'm always filming. I'm always capturing something, even if I don't always reference it. So then I'll film it and I'll make my observations, my naked eye observations. And I've seen enough of them just from collecting it. So if you want to improve your coach's eye, if you don't always have the resources of filming with an iPhone, I think almost everyone does, but if for whatever reason you're limited in that regard, I think just looking at videos, getting acquainted with some variables, collecting some stuff. It doesn't have to be fancy lab equipment or anything like that. But I think if you collect data, just the more data you collect and get familiar with it, then you'll see the times when your intuition has failed you the most often, and then you won't make those assumptions anymore. So I've looked at thousands of videos of athletes doing block starts, and I've filmed 1,000 block starts in the lab, and you see what's happening with your naked eye, but then you get acquainted with the data and you think, oh wait, actually I didn't see what I thought I saw, because it happens in a flash.
Yep.
So you learn, like I said, I'll just rephrase it. You'll learn where your coach's eye was not reliable in the past by actually fact checking it, so to speak.
Yeah.
From your own actual analysis. And then you stop making those same mistakes because you no longer make those assumptions. Ooh. So then you can, it helps refine your coach's eye.
That makes a ton of sense. And I want our listeners to rehear that, because I feel like a lot of times I see strength coaches doing these waterfall starts and go back and kind of watch the film to make sure that you're not saying something that's wrong, because you want to be giving athletes the proper feedback.
Right.
Huh. That makes a ton of really good sense. You talked about the high speed treadmill. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's still only the one force plate track, and that's in Japan, or where is that?
It's in Japan. It's I think it's like 40 meters of force plates or something like that. It's just an incredible facility. I haven't been there myself, but I read about it and you see pictures, like, it's incredible. I will say the TCU lab that's being built, my advisor is building, it's underway there. I think they have some lab function already underway, but they're building a runway, but it's not
really
40 meters, but yeah, they have, force plates already in the ground. So they're going to have a string of force plates in a row, right there in Fort Worth. So,
I am going to be telling, I'm going to be sending that clip right there to RJ to send it to the staff.
Yeah, that stuff's, it's stuff's on its way. So
that is fantastic. What would you say is the biggest thing that you would like to see strength coaches doing a better job as practitioners or wearing the scientist hat? Because you said you never take yours off when working with athletes. How would you say strength coaches can do a better job of keeping their scientist hat on?
That's a really good question. And I have all kinds of opinions. We can do a podcast series about my opinions on these things. But I would say just generally, because I think that this one thing can pretty much encapsulate most of the things that I have issues with, is anytime there's a new concept or a new idea or a new product or like a new variable or phrase or it's like training system, I think that there needs to be more scrutiny. Not skepticism. Well, not cynicism. Skepticism, I think, should remain. Because the skepticism is what's allowed me to throw certain ideas, you know, take it behind the barn, so to speak. So healthy skepticism, just short of cynicism, because if you want to believe as many true things as possible, you believe everything. If you want to believe as few false things as possible, you believe nothing. So you have to apply a filter. And how strong that filter is going to be determined by how much homework you do and how much you think about something and how many questions you ask. So let's say someone comes up with this proprietary training formula, this new gadget, and that this is going to revolutionize the game, the field. No, you're never going to train the same way again. The more the best thing since sliced bread, you don't want to miss out. So you're just going to jump on board. And so you're going to believe it just on the off chance that it does deliver. If you don't want to take that risk and say, I'm just going to write this off because I don't want to be wrong about it, then you just say, because I don't want to do the wrong thing. Then you say, okay, I'm going to write it off without pursuing it further. I think both sides of those equation are equally lazy, and there just needs to be more questions and there needs to be more homework. And I get it. It's tough to engage with athletes in the volumes that some of these coaches do. They have busy days. But there's a way to strike a balance to where you don't have to be an expert in all these first principles of Newtonian mechanics and the physiology like I have to be for my role in the field. That's my job, right? I'm doing this so that practitioners don't necessarily have to.
Amen.
But with that, I want to be questioned as well. I think they don't have to be experts, but they have to be expert questioners.
No,
they have to be interrogators, so to speak.
Yeah, because it has to be able to, you know, from the movie My Cousin Vinny, does it hold water?
Like,
it has to hold water.
Right.
Huh.
It can't fold under scrutiny.
No, it can't, because then otherwise you don't actually have principles.
Exactly. So I think that one thing would sort of correct a lot of the other issues I have. Because if we had more of that, but health, like I said, healthy skepticism is a far cry from cynicism. And then blind acceptance would be the opposite of that. So you want to be in the middle of that.
Off at the door.
Exactly. You want to be right in the middle of that.
Hey, man, I think that's a good place to end it, because I want to respect your time with all the other things you have going on, setting up. Why don't you let everybody know where you're at now? Because, as you said, you had relocated to the great state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, sure did. Yeah, I'm currently doing a serving a postdoc at it's a NIH funded collaboration with UMass Lowell and Harvard University. I'm at the Concord Field Station doing comparative biology experiments and in various animal models. We're basically measuring and investigating muscle behavior, and getting to lump that in with my elite athlete whole body biomechanics experience is giving me a very wide perspective on muscle function and performance across biological scales from the body all the way down to the cell. So exciting stuff we're doing. And also we've launched a Brooks Performance Methods, and we have a website coming soon and some various resources for athletes and coaches that people should keep an eye out for.
We will link all of that down below so people can continue to follow you and, you know, see the research, as you said, that'll be coming out soon. So
sounds great,
brother, for coming on, and have a great rest of your day.
Dr. Lima, thank you very much.
See ya.